My name is Robert Slaughter. I'm from Oakland, California, and I'm 22 years old.
And you were involved in the Occupy movement, in particular in the Berkeley Occupy movement, probably on campus at SMC as well. What is it that drew you to get involved in the Occupy movement? What did it mean to you?
Well, what really drew me to get involved in the Occupy movement is the fact that, like, there's college students all around the world who are voicing financial concerns. And that, in general, as college students, we all have, like, this issue. When something affects one of our fellow college students, it affects us. So that's what really drew me into the Occupy movement, and the fact that there's young people that's taking a change and a stance in what they want their society to look like, and they want to form that society. And out of that, I want to be one of those people that's going to have the reins and control to form their own society.
And for you, what was at stake for you? What are some of maybe the life obstacles that you had to go through to really get to where you are today? What did it mean for you, not only as a college student, but as a person with roots in Oakland?
Well, having roots in Oakland, it comes at a huge price, because of the fact that when I come from Oakland, and even look at the history of it, it's the history of the Black Panther Party. And so I'm always constantly reminded of their legacy that they left us, because they put down a lot on the line. They made huge sacrifices for people like me to be here today. The Occupy movement in itself, I would have to say, is that they used legacies like that, the legacies of Black Panther Party, Mario Savio, the Free Speech Movement, Vietnam War, and they expand upon it. And as college students, we see that legacy, and we come to understand that we need to make a change in our society. And along with that, it's our turn to basically expand that road and that pathway that has been paved for us by past revolutionaries, people of change, people that put their life on the line so that we can live a better life of sustainability.
And for you, as someone who grew up as a Black male in Oakland, what are some of the personal struggles, if you don't mind sharing, that you had to go through in probably the same area that you were seeing people occupying?
Basically, like, in Oakland, it's a huge divide between the people and the law enforcement, especially when you look at things like the Oscar Grant, or how, like, the police involved dismantled the Black Panther Party. So you have a divide of the citizens of Oakland basically having a strong vengeance and revenge, and even a hatred towards the police department in Oakland. They're really known for being very brutal, very violent people, mainly in regards to the police department. And so as a young Black male being in Oakland, for me, I always have, like, fears and phobias of walking down the street, wondering if I'm going to be the next Oscar Grant, you know, what cop is going to try to, like, shoot me, or, like, lie and say that he was trying to taser me and wind up, like, taking my life away from me. So it's almost like you have that PTSD type syndrome living, almost like as if you're a Palestinian living in an Iraqi occupation, in a sense, because you're always wondering what's going to happen to you, especially because of the color of your skin, and in a city like that that's polarized by political and police racism. You're wondering, you know, what day is going to be the last, how are you even going to get by or survive in that? So,
and so the irony is that you made it through, even though you had those fears, you made it through your entire life in Oakland without really having to encounter one of those instances, correct? Mm-hmm. And it was when you were at the UC Berkeley campus, standing in solidarity with UC Berkeley students, that you had a little bit of an incident. Mm-hmm. Talk about what drew you there, when it was, and kind of what the breakdown was, as succinct as possible.
Yeah, definitely. So on November 9th, I got an email basically from some of my friends at UC Berkeley saying, you know, we're starting up our occupation. And so after I read that email, I'm like, I have to go out there, because I really have strong feelings towards Cal, mainly because of the fact that, like, it's like one of the most at the forefront of political activism, especially during the free speech movement. And anytime something of social injustice happens, they're always the first one to take a stand. And so I always respect that and embody that. So on that day, what happened was I got that email, and I went to my class at St. Mary's, you know, basically did, like, the normal college thing, go to classes, da da da. And after that, I basically went over to Cal. I gave an interview to KPFA with Davey D, and I addressed the General Assembly at Cal, basically saying that St. Mary's, you know, supports them. After that, I ran to my friend Melissa, and so we decided to link arms. And, you know, I kept hearing rumors that the police were going to come. And, you know, me, I'm sitting there thinking it's not going to be that bad. Mainly because of being at St. Mary's, you know, our public safety, they don't carry badges. They don't carry guns or batons or things like that. And they show really no harm towards the students. They're actually part of our student, our college community. And so when I see these officers come up to us, you know, some of them are looking timid like they don't want to be here. And I guess the sergeant picked up on that. And so after that, he wound up taking those guys away and putting on, and then right before us, you see Alameda County Sheriff's Department, Oakland PD. And from that moment on, I was just like, this is going to be ugly because of the fact that I know the history of those police departments and how brutal they are. And they don't treat people like human beings. So after that, you know, I'm hearing random things, and as soon as I look to the left of me, an officer starts striking a person on the side of me, like in the head and the arms and stuff. And then I turn to my right, and I see a woman that's basically being stabbed in her stomach by a baton. And then another woman is basically being yanked out of the crowd by her hair and stuff. And so I'm sitting there, at this moment, I'm feeling like we're in war. Like we're just at war. Like, we're defenseless. You guys have badges, guns, batons, the whole nine yards. And that's when I feel like that officer's arm on my shoulder, and he ripped me out of the crowd. And then next thing I know, I'm basically on the ground being handcuffed. And so that's when the five other officers or six other officers came and started kicking me inside of my ribs and stomping on me. And on my left side, an officer pulls out his baton and he starts stabbing me in the left side of my ribs. and then shortly after that, another officer jumped on top of me, puts his knee into my neck, and then he starts to violently, like, strangle me. And so at that moment, I realized, you know, that it was like a life or death situation. And that from that moment forward, I no longer trust police officers, law enforcement. I'm actually against them. And if the society that we live in needs something that's going to be like safety enforcement, I think we should have people like public safety walking around with, you know, no badges, no guns, nothing like that. But basically, they should be part of the community and view everybody as human beings versus as wild savages or animals that have no emotions or feelings or regard.
And then for you, you ended up having to, you were detained somewhere and then you were actually taken away to a prison. Give me a brief overview of that story.
Yeah, definitely. So after that, what's wound up happening is I was sent over to Glen Dyer, which is the Oakland little like facility or little temporary jail holding facility. And in there, I was with the other students that were arrested at Occupy Cal. And in the room that we were in, it was really filthy, really atrocious. You had basically feces all over the toilet, urine all over the floors, food that was just molded, and it was just inhumane. It wouldn't have passed health and safety inspections at all. So after that, those students are cited and released, and I'm basically held for another night. I'm wondering, you know, when am I going to be released? I'm asking these guys, can I get a phone call? And they're sitting there telling me, oh, no, don't worry about it. You know, that'll all come. You know, we don't know why we're holding you. So I'm just like, at this point, I'm like, you guys should let me go then if you don't know, you know. So I would basically wind up waking up the next morning to find out that they shipped me over to Santa Rita County Jail, which is notoriously known like as second right behind San Quentin for murderers and things like that or whatever. So they wind up sending me off there basically. And when I get there, you know, I'm strip searched, naked and everything, you know, they're checking your private areas and things like that or whatever. And there's no respect for you as a human being. You're not even respected or even acknowledged as a human being, but more as if you're like a state property in a sense. So I felt like it was like a version of basically being in I guess you can say slavery in a sense.
This is at Santa Rita, right? You're talking about. And you said most of the other people who were there with you were in for much bigger types of crimes.
Yeah, bigger types of crimes. They had a couple guys that murdered people, people that was in there for armed robbery, DUIs, and things like that, and like petty theft. Some of the guys I met were in there for DUIs and robbery. And it's really interesting because when these guys approached me, they were just asked me, you know, where are you from? And I told them Oakland. And they're like, what are you in here for? And I'm like, protesting. And they're like, were you one of the guys that occupied Cal? And I was just like, yes. And from that moment on, they were basically just like, well, you know, screw this. We're going to protect you because you're out there fighting for not only yourselves and your college students, but also for us. Because, you know, we are the voiceless and we support what you guys are doing, even though we can't come out there and publicly like say that and be out there, you know, because we're like sadly locked behind bars in the prison industrial complex, but we support you guys and what you guys are doing.
And how many Occupy people were in Santa Rita with you?
I was the only one, actually. The other people were just cited and released. I was the only one and the only African-American male in the group, actually. So that's comes with highly huge amounts of recognition and I guess you can say speculation as well.
The only person at Santa Rita that was African-American or the only person at the Occupy movement who was African-American who was arrested?
Yeah, the only African-American that was arrested in the Occupy Cal group that was sent off to Santa Rita.
Okay, and so the others who were arrested were mostly what racial background?
Mostly like white, Asian. You had a couple Hispanics and Brazilians in there, but the general population of them were like Caucasian and Asian Pacific Islander.
And they were all let go?
Yeah, they were all let go, and they were all Cal students, yeah.
So did you feel targeted on the basis of being a black man?
At first when it all happened, I wasn't thinking about it in like the racial aspect, but then when you had that time to debrief and basically think about it, analyze it, then yes, you start to realize that this might also be a racial component in there. Especially with the fact that when you look at the line of officers that's on top of you and from the photos and everything, they're all white. So that had a huge, play when I was basically analyzing and, trying to figure out, you know, like the racial dynamics and like the political, dynamics that were going on that night.
And the fact that the others were detained for a temporary time and let go, and you were then taken off to a more serious. Yeah. And what are the charges that they have alleged they might be filing against you?
Yeah, so at first they tried to get me with a felony, which was dropped, but now they're trying to get me with failure to disperse, deterring a peace officer, and battery. And from what my lawyer was telling me is that they normally try to stick you with battery when they basically have beaten you up or whatever to make it seem as if they had just caused to basically do that to you, to basically cover their asses in a sense.
And so for the battery piece, I think you had shared that you were sort of shrugging the officer off, or how is it that they even threw that piece on you?
Yeah, from what I believe, I think it was mainly because of the fact that when the officer grabbed me, I was basically trying to like, you know, like get him like away from me, you know, basically trying to like get out of his grip. Mainly because of the fact that like once you see what's going around you, you see your fellow students being beaten in the head and basically ripped out by the hair and stuff. You don't want to be in that situation, that environment at all, because you're wondering, you know, what is this officer going to do to me? Is he going to pull me by my hair, hit me in the private region, or even hit me in the stomach? And you're defenseless. So the best thing for you to do is basically try to get away from that.
Got it. So that's what you're trying to kind of squirm away, get out of the situation. You're saying stop it, and then out of that is the battery charge.
Yeah.
Okay, so then you're at Santa Rita, and do you spend the night there?
At Santa Rita, yeah, I wind up spending the night there. And while I'm there, I'm, like, experiencing so much stuff, just the disrespect that the prisoners basically have to put up with. A couple of the officers, I remember, like, there was this old man there. And, you know, he seemed like he was a senior citizen, you know, kind of scruffed up and stuff. And as he's walking, one of the deputies is behind him. And he sits there and tells the guy, well, you know what, why don't you put a pep in your step, old man? I'm not going to pick up your shit for you. And I'm just like, wow, like, this is an old man. He's a senior citizen. He has feelings. Just because he has a jumpsuit and chains does not mean that he's, like, state property or something. Then upon this, we basically take him to a room and where the cavity search is done, where they basically have to, like, check your region, your private areas, stuff like that or whatever, which is just totally, like, you feel violated. And you can't do anything about it. And so upon this, I guess there was another new guy in there, and he didn't know how to, like, I guess, wrinkle or shake out his jail apparel pants. And so upon him doing this, the officer gets really mad, and he just tells everybody, you know, just put back on your clothes. He's like, you know, I'm not a faggot, I'm not gay, and I'm not here to stare at guys' asses all day. So why don't you guys just put back on your fucking clothes. And that was really just, that really traumatized me, just like knowing that you have this officer here that's supposed to protect and serve. And he's sitting there saying this type of stuff and not even being, like, you know, critically aware of what he's doing and saying, and not even, like, understanding that these are people, they have emotions and feelings, too. So that was just really traumatizing, and just to understand that actually goes on in the prison industrial complex is just atrocious, and you start to learn that from reading about the prison and also being in there, totally two different things that a lot of people don't really get the experience to understand and get knowledge about.
So then you get out of prison. Talk me through that.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's even crazy. So my lawyer basically tells me, you know, you're going to be released today. That's what we're going to try to do. And I was released that day. And as I'm basically leaving out of my cell, some of the inmates starts banging on the door, and they're like, "Where are you going?" And I'm like, "I'm going home." And they start banging even louder because, you know, for them that was a sign of solidarity. You know, that one of basically, you know, their fellow inmates was released to basically go out and fight the struggle. So upon me being released, you have to be checked again, by another officer to make sure you don't have anything on you and things like that, back at the general population in that same room that, you know, had the feces covered toilets and the urine and stuff like that. So upon me doing that, you know, like the officer checks me and stuff, and then I'm thinking he's done. So I put my foot forward, and he's like an older, he's like an older white cop, and he sits there and taunts me, and he's just like, you know, you don't want to put your foot forward. Don't do that. You know, Fred, don't do that. You don't want to test me. And so I'm like, why is he doing this? You know? And, you know, I apologize, you know, tell him, you know, I'm new here, this is my first time. And so after he finishes checking me, I'm thinking he's done. And so I guess he's not done. So I put my other foot forward, and he does it again. You know, don't do that. Don't put your foot forward. And then he says, you know, I just might have to kill you. I might have to shoot you or something, you know, and you don't want that to happen. You can't walk up on me like that. And at this point, I'm just like, you know, I'm like speechless, traumatized, and even shocked by him saying this on top of the original trauma that from being in there and being beaten up. And just to know that, like, this officer can shoot me at any given moment, and it'd be swept under the rug because, himself along with the other officers in here will basically cover it up and save their asses. To me, I felt like I was not even safe being in that zone at all. I didn't even see these guys as people. I just saw them as, almost in a way kind of like, slave guards protecting and watching over, slaves, who were not even considered equal to them. And so you definitely got that feeling from it. So upon me being released, I basically walk out the door, and I see the vice provost for St. Mary's and a couple of my other friends and comrades there. And a lot of my friends say, you know, when we first saw you come out, you had this giant smile on your face that I would never forget. And I told them, I'm like, that smile was because I got the hell up out of there. Like, that was not a good feeling at all. And I actually felt like I was in, like, the confines of safety. Basically, I felt like almost like being like Che Guevara going to Bolivia. But instead of dying, you're basically, you had the opportunity to come back alive and continue doing what you're doing.
And you, in order to get out, somebody had to post bail for you. Mm-hmm. How much bail did they post and who did it for you?
Yeah. So my bail was originally set at $15,000, which, also, aside from me being the only African American male, was the only person that had the highest bail out of anybody that has been detained for Occupy Cal movement. And then on top of that, my friend, Max Bell Alpepper, who also works with the hotel union workers, he actually paid my bail, which is you're only supposed to pay like a certain percent, and he only had to pay like $1,500 to get me out of bail. And so him and my other students at St. Mary's, Randy Minivar, and all those guys, they started doing organizing and fundraising to help Max also get me out of jail. So, yeah, so that went really well and successful.
So people kind of stepped up and got you out.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, in retrospect, you're somebody who's been, you're an activist, you're an organizer, you're somebody who always takes action, and I don't see you as someone who's standing on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. And now you've gone through this whole experience. What would you say is the most important lesson that you've learned from these collective experiences?
Well, like, after analyzing the whole entire situation, I start to realize that people in society might seem like they don't care, but it seems like when a situation like mine happens, or like the incident at UC Davis with the students being pepper sprayed, who I got to talk to, that's when you have that strong sense of solidarity, and when people start to realize the common ground, and that's when they start to come together. And when they start to come together, then that's when you see an overall momentum of a movement taking shape and moving forward.
So where do you see this movement going from here on out, and where do you see yourself going from here on out?
That's a good question, because in this movement, my main focus is basically uniting all the colleges on the West Coast. And then once you do that, then that's going to also spread. But the Occupy movement, I don't think it's going to really die out. I think it's going to add the fuel and the fire to more people. But what I'm really concerned about is that in January, election season is coming around. And so I already know that the Democrats and Republicans are probably going to start to use the fuel and momentum of the Occupy movement to fund their own personal elections, which I've been told will not happen. The people will not let it happen. But I think the Occupy movement, what it's doing is really good. It's basically waking up our general population and our society and getting them to realize that there's a bigger picture and that we all need to have our own personal stake in our movement and in our society if we want to transition and transform it into something that's going to benefit all people of our nation and across the wider vast majorities of land.
And another, just only a couple left, but so the rhythm of change, what does that mean to you as a person, as an activist, as a student, and how does it apply to your life?
Yeah. So rhythms of change to me, is basically, it kind of reminds me of like, it's almost like you get, to, I guess I can say like earthquakes of change in a sense, in the regards to the aspect of like, you know, it seems like it's almost seasonal, like different movements come about. But even though those movements might be different, or the rhythm of them, or the beat, might, or momentum might be, of those movements might be different, they still have a common cause and a common message that's going to revitalize and wake up the people, to get them to understand that, hey, like, your society and humanity needs you. And different people come from different backgrounds, which I also think contributes greatly to those rhythms of change, which makes the movement in itself different with different dynamics and political personalities and ideologies. So I think that when you have different rhythms of change, you have different momentums and focus points for the movement and for basically the main center ideologies of people that they start to pick up on and expand upon and learn about.
And so for you as a person who's kind of been through these and you've been through different movements and sometimes they work out the way you want them to and sometimes not, on a personal level, how has kind of the rhythm of change applied for you, or how has, you know, any other lessons that you'd want to add on based on what you've experienced?
It's taught me a lot, because I know constantly, like I tell people every day, like my political ideas are and beliefs change every day, mainly because of the fact that I meet with different people from different spectrums, and they start to teach me a lot. Like on a daily basis, I have conversations and work with people who are socialists, communists, anarchists, the whole nine yards, even pacifists. And so in those conversations, you start to see the genius that's brought out of that craziness. And you start to learn that, hey, like even though this person might not agree with you on this certain political point, that they believe this political point that also contributes to your knowledge and your awareness of how to get the movement started and the overall succession and objective of the movement to be completed. So I think when you bring all those people together, you have different outlets and different backgrounds and different talents that contribute to the movement. And when you see those from the outside perspective, it's a really beautiful blossoming thing.
You talked about really wanting to get rid of the police state and wishing we had a different alternative to that. I think part of that is really teaching people how not to be bystanders, how to be active and intervening. So I want to hear some of your thoughts on that. You are a man of color, but you've also been a fantastic ally to women. So why do you think it's important to address these issues as a whole?
Because like when I look about it, when I look at the movement in general, or just social movements in general, the person that's at the forefront of it or even involved in it has to have a mentality in regards to, or in the mindset of the following. You know, they have to constantly think about, you know, how will the movement benefit humanity as a whole, not how is the movement going to benefit me? Because when you are involved and invested in a movement like this, you have to basically be a person that does not come from selfish or individualistic backgrounds. You have to be willing to give up certain things for the people in order for the advancement of the movement. But for me in particular, I feel like a lot of my knowledge comes from people that are from all different walks of life, women in general, because like women start to teach me like, you know, like the love and compassion part for the movement. Men start to teach me, you know, how we have to basically man up to the challenges that we face ahead. And that, you know, we have to kind of like be that disciplined role model. So I start to pick up a lot of these different aspects from different people and stuff. Even when you get down into it politically, one group that I really love is the anarchists. Because when certain movements happen, like the Oscar Grant riots or even in Occupy Oakland, they're the first ones that's not scared to basically take something up and break it. And a lot of people see that as like an act of violence. But for me, I see it as kind of like an act of frustration. It's the only way that they know how to basically explain themselves or describe what's going on through their own mental fatigue. And even politically. And so when you start to see things like that, you start to basically understand like the different backgrounds that people come from and their different struggles that they're going through and how they the best way for them to express themselves. Even in this movement as like humanity as whole, when you look at them, humanity doesn't just comprise of basically the dominant male or the Democrat or the Republican, but encompasses everybody. And that also includes women, lesbians, you know, transgender people from different sexualities, orientations, the whole nine yards. Because if you did not include those people in the movement or even acknowledge them as human beings, then what's the overall objective of your goal and what's your stake in the movement? Because if the movement's going to affect everybody, you can't leave certain people out of it. So you have to learn how to communicate with those people and learn what they've been through and their struggles. And that's also going to teach you something very valuable that you can give to other people who don't know about those issues and contribute to the movement as a whole.
So it sounds like you really resonate with that old labor phrase, an injury to one is an injury to all.
Exactly. Like two of my favorite quotes that I always constantly remind myself of when I wake up in the morning is one of them was by a Bolivian revolutionary. It might have been a Bolivian revolutionary by the name of Tupac Katari. And he said upon himself dying that I may die as one, but I'm going to come back in millions. And so that has always resonated with me. So especially when I'm talking to, you know, college students or just political activists in Oakland or in San Francisco. Because when you're out there, you start to see yourself as millions of people representing one ideal or one political agenda. And then the other one was Steve Jobs once said before he died that even in regards to people who think that they're crazy, in that craziness, we tend to find genius. And so that's one of my favorite quotes that I definitely take to heart, because I feel like out of a lot of crazy situations, like the one that happened to me, the ones that happened to the students at pepper sprayed at UC Davis, and even like being in the scene of seeing people getting beat up and just violated, you start to find that genius in that and how to use that momentum for the better state of society.
We do all this work, right, with all these different movements, mm-hmm. and change might happen or it might not. So some would say, what's the point? So what is the point?
Well, it always brings me back to what Obama first said in his 2008 election that I'll never forget. And he told us that, you know, we are the ones that we've been waiting for. And I think that's a quote that particularly sticks with this movement really well, and that we have to constantly remind ourselves in our country that we are the ones that our country has been waiting for. Even if our politicians and our government disagrees with us, you know, without the people, you know, there would be no government. So we are the backbone to the government, to our own movement. But in regards to basically like what you said, what's the point? If we didn't have a point, or if people were not all over the country, like rioting and occupying, which is very symbolic, and taking back property that they, in essence, own, then we basically have, in a sense, I feel like, a dictatorship of government, in which the government would basically be ruling our lives, almost in the sense of like a Vita Vendetta type of theme. And I don't think people are ready for that, and they're not going to be tolerated. To that happening in their country, because they start to realize how much that we have to lose. And in essence, we have our overall freedom and our livelihood at stake. And so that's something that the people aren't willing to give up, because that makes them up. That's what basically some symbolizes and, in a sense, describes what humanity is all about. If I'm an illegal immigrant, you know, and I come from Mexico, I should have the right to be able to go to a school in America. You know, I shouldn't be targeted for the fact that, you know, I don't have papers or I wasn't born here. And it shouldn't be frowned upon, because in essence, when you look at America, what is the American dream? You know, this country was founded on immigrants coming from Europe and basically, you know, trying to find a better stake for themselves in the new world. And so I don't see any difference from the Chicanos or the illegal immigrants doing that now. You know, I see them as people that deserve every single right that we have in this country. Some of the rights, you know, we earned and some other ones we didn't. And it was only at the expense of people losing their lives that we have those rights. And those people should be entitled to it, too. So you start to see that people in America start to realize, even abroad, that we have a lot to lose if we basically give up and just put our pitchforks down and go back home. We have government that's basically trying to control our lives, and that's not going to happen.
Right. So you're saying that regardless what how much change happens or doesn't happen, there's no alternative to trying to at least make change, right?
Exactly. Anybody has the ability to make change. I know a lot of times I hear people all the time, you know, criticizing certain people that are trying to make change and make it come about. But the thing that you have to realize is that, that I always constantly try to remind myself is like, how can you criticize somebody else for making change when you yourself aren't doing anything to help that change or that progression of it? You don't really have a right to especially criticize somebody that's making a change that's going to overall benefit you. So we have to basically, instead of like critically, like, you know, putting somebody down and trying to be a change maker, you should figure out a way to help them more. And basically have a sense of humanity when you're doing it.